Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
Make a plan with your family of what you would do in a power outage. There's never a better time to plan for an emergency than before it happens.
A widespread power outage in South Central renews calls for emergency preparedness. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, August 13th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Fairbanks scientists find methane from thawing permafrost in a place they had not suspected.
We need to understand what the fate of Yetama permafrost thaw is if we're going to accurately predict climate feedbacks.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly. With cyber attacks on the healthcare industry becoming increasingly common, a Washington woman is suing an Alaska-based behavioral health provider related to a 2023 data breach. As KRBD's Jack Darrell reports, the lawsuit claims it wasn't until last month that the nonprofit told former patients their personal data had been stolen.
Aquila Inc. has facilities in Homer, Kenai, and Anchorage. They shuttered their operations in Ketchikan earlier this summer. So when a patient is admitted to one of Aquila's programs, they have to provide intake information, like many healthcare providers ask for. You know, things like date of birth, social security number, diagnostic and health treatment info. And because of this, the American Hospital Association says medical providers, like Aquila, are worth a pretty penny to hackers. And in late July, current and former patients of Aquila's substance abuse and mental health programs received a letter saying the provider had been the victim of a cyber attack. According to the recent lawsuit filed against the nonprofit, the personal and medical information of over 280,000 patients was stolen. But the thing is, the letter says the breach happened around June of 2023, over a year before the letter went out. So one of those people, a former Aquila patient living in Washington State, is suing the organization. The lawsuit alleges negligence, breach of contract, and invasion of privacy, among other things. According to the lawsuit, Aquila failed to take the proper industry standard measures to safeguard their patients' information. Information that now puts them in danger of identity theft, fraud, and further cybercrime, potentially for the rest of their lives. And by doing so, the complaint says the behavioral health provider has breached both its fiduciary contract, basically by not using the money patients paid them to adequately protect their identities, and their legal contract with patients. Aquila has a notice of client privacy practices on its website that states, quote, "Aquila is required by law to maintain the privacy of your health information," unquote. The law firm that filed the class action suit on behalf of the plaintiff didn't return KRBD's emails or phone calls about the lawsuit. But it can be costly to mitigate the risk of having one's personal data stolen. It often requires time and money put into credit monitoring, email accounts, and other preventative measures. Plus, there's the possibility of a lot more scam texts and phone calls. The lawsuit claims that if Aquila had alerted their patients in a timely manner, as in not a year later, they could have gotten a jump on those measures a lot sooner. It goes on to say that there have already been reports of identity theft and fraud among patients as a result of the breach. Aquila also didn't respond to multiple phone and email requests for comment by press time. In Ketchikan, I'm Jack Darrell.
U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan stopped by Delta Junction this weekend during a road trip around the interior to meet with constituents. The senator talked about a new study on declining salmon populations and heard residents' feedback about agriculture, infrastructure, and emergency services. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
It's August and the Senate is in recess, so Sullivan and his staff embarked on a road trip Saturday to talk with Alaskans around the state about what's on their mind.
We're going to be in Glen Allen, Gulkana, Valdez, taking the Marine Highway to Whittier, back to Anchorage, and we're going to be heading to St. Paul, Kotzebue, a North Slope.
Sullivan says, among other things, he wants to share a new report by the Alaska Salmon Research Task Force that outlines its plans to investigate declining salmon run causes and solutions.
We've seen some devastating runs on some of our most important rivers, the Yukon, Kuskokwim, some of our most iconic species, think Yukon King.
The senator sponsored legislation 2 years ago that created the study group, which he says calls for more federal funding and a variety of perspectives on the issue.
We know different stakeholder groups have different interests, different views. Let's all kind of put down our swords and kind of trust each other here to know that we're going for the same goal, which is strong, healthy, sustainable salmon fisheries throughout our state.
Sullivan says the task force report is the first step in what's likely to be a long path to solutions. Meanwhile, he said he heard an upbeat report on food security from a group in Delta Junction.
I just was on a farm with 1,000 head of cattle, and pretty amazing. Who knew?
Sullivan says area farmers and ranchers asked him about funding for Alaska in the farm bill that Congress is working on, and they emphasized the importance of maintaining support for the Cooperative Extension Service and the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
You know, we have the potential to turn Alaska into a really big farming state.
He says farmers and others voiced support for better transportation infrastructure, including a railroad extension to bring in supplies like fertilizer and to export locally produced grains and other food products. Sullivan says he supports a rail line extension because it would benefit the state and take pressure off the highway system that's increasingly being used to haul heavy loads.
In so many ways, our military, our national security, our resource development sector, our ag sector, just our overall economy.
Sullivan says the Defense Department's buildup in Alaska will continue because the National Defense Authorization Act before Congress includes $800 million for military construction in Alaska. Delta area residents and community leaders also asked for funding to support ambulance service.
This is always a challenge with regard to healthcare delivery in our rural communities, and we want to be able to try to work with the community and bring some solutions to an issue that I think is concerning a lot of people.
Sullivan's likely to hear more about the issue in Glen Allen, which also is struggling to pay for ambulance service. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
A power line problem triggered yesterday's brief but widespread power outage that impacted tens of thousands of South Central Alaskans as utilities tried to prevent a wider blackout. Chugach Electric spokesperson Julie Haskett says that while the 90-minute outage eventually affected about half of the company's members, it didn't cut all Anchorage power, as some had claimed on social media.
There were parts of the hillside that were unaffected. There were parts of Midtown that were unaffected. It was definitely not all of the city.
The outage began at about 5:30 p.m. Monday when a fault in a transmission line near Wasilla took two generators offline. Haskett says that caused Chugach and the Matanuska Electric Association to cut power for about 65,000 members in a planned load-shedding response to keep the overall system running. Haskett says the incident is a good reminder for Alaskans to prepare for power losses heading into the fall.
Make a plan with your family of what you would do in a power outage. There's never a better time to plan for an emergency than before it happens.
She says the utilities are still investigating what caused the initial fault. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, new Latin American restaurants highlight Alaska's growing Hispanic community.
You hear Spanish everywhere, and it's not just from, you know, one specific country. It's from any country in Latin America.
That's ahead. Stay with us. University of Alaska Fairbanks scientists have documented the potent greenhouse gas methane coming from dry uplands of thawing permafrost. As KUAC's Robin reports, the discovery is adding to global climate change concerns.
Dr. Katie Walter Anthony is known for her methane studies. You've probably seen a picture or a video of her and a colleague or two poking a hole in lake ice and lighting the escaping gas on fire. Very Alaskan. So about 6 years ago, when KUAC reporter Ravina Koenig called Walter Anthony to confirm that a gas bubble under the grass at a local golf course was actually methane, she got her tools and went to the site.
So I collected some of the methane and radiocarbon dated it and found out that it was thousands of years old. And that tells us the source of the methane is thawing permafrost.
As the ground thaws, the stored organic matter in the soil breaks down and becomes accessible to carbon-eating microbes that produce methane. The bulb of gas under a lawn was a surprise to Walter Anthony because scientists had concluded that if you want to see a lot of methane leaking out of thawing permafrost, you have to go to a wetland.
Usually we think of these anaerobic microbes as living in waterlogged environments, lakes and wetlands. So what was so shocking here is that we were seeing methane coming out of dry ground surfaces.
She was curious to see how widespread these turf bubbles might be across Alaska's permafrost region. So when Russia's invasion of Ukraine shelved a planned permafrost study in Siberia, she used the equipment here at home.
So I went into other grasslands, farm fields that had been cleared in the past, spruce forests, deciduous forests, all these places where there were signs that permafrost thaw was happening, but no water at the surface. And I repeatedly found methane coming out of these environments.
Walter Anthony found that these bulbs or balloons of gas were forming where the permafrost had thawed dozens of feet deep, making the stored carbon in the soil easier for the microbes to get to.
The type of permafrost we looked at is called Yetima, and it's the permafrost that people would associate the mammoth ecosystem from the past, from the last ice age.
The Yetima soils are composed of decaying ancient grasslands that are many meters deep, so there's a lot of carbon there.
It's a unique type of permafrost. It's only about 7% of the permafrost region in the north, but the amount of carbon it stores is closer to 25%. So Yetima is kind of a hot spot bank account for permafrost carbon.
In the study published last month in the journal Nature Communications, Walter Anthony and her UAF colleagues identified some upland places that are actually surprisingly large methane sources.
And in winter, at a time of year when most other methane systems are shutting down, these ones really start emitting a lot of gas.
Walter Anthony thinks the next step is to build these new data into the climate change models and to continue looking for methane-emitting Yetima soils across the Arctic.
It's particularly important. We need to understand what the fate of Yetima permafrost thaw is if we're going to accurately predict climate feedbacks.
Starting locally, Walter Anthony plans to design a new study to assess dry land methane at the same local golf course. In Fairbanks, I'm Robin.
This summer, dozens of rising fourth graders on the Kenai Peninsula are heading back to school early for summer reading intervention classes as part of the Alaska Reads Act. As KDLL's Ashlyn O'Hara reports, district staff hope the summer instruction will give those students a leg up ahead of the school year that starts next week.
Last Friday, Tanya Irwin sat in her classroom at Kalifornsky Beach Elementary School working with two third grade students on phonemic awareness.
Say third.
Third.
Without the...
Good.
We play with sounds. I call it word games, but it's phonemic awareness. And it's because when you're sounding out words, you have to kind of play with the sounds until it sounds like the word that you recognize.
Most students in the Kenai Peninsula Borough School District don't go back to school until next week. But for the more than 120 third graders who tested below benchmark in reading at the end of last semester, school started a little earlier than usual. Under the Alaska Reads Act, those students either had to be held back a year or undergo 20 hours of additional literacy practice before starting fourth grade. Parents were able to pick between a paper workbook, an online program, and 5 days of in-person instruction, or a combination to meet that 20-hour requirement. Janae Van Slyke is the principal at K Beach Elementary. On Friday, she said scheduling the sessions close to the start of the 2024-2025 school year was intentional to counteract what she called the summer slide.
What happens over the summer is they might not be reading as much as they would if they were in school for 6 hours a day, even if they are doing 20 minutes of reading at home every night. And so the idea of having this little boost of summer school right before school starts is to give them that extra plug before they go back into school.
About half of the students who needed summer reading intervention opted for the in-person option. It wasn't always guaranteed that option would be available, but the district received a $100,000 grant from the state that is helping pay for staff, student transportation, and snacks. In all, 12 of the district's 42 schools offered in-person instruction this summer. The grant meant the district could afford to cap the student-to-teacher ratio at 10 students per teacher. At Kay Beach, 6 students participated in in-person instruction with 2 teachers. Van Slyke said small group sizes are to the students' benefit.
We know having kids in person is what's best for reading instruction and all instruction. So to be able to have kids come in during the summer and get to work in small groups and focus on their learning based on where their instructional knowledge is currently at and meeting individual needs, it's an incredible opportunity and we're really happy about it.
Melissa Linton, the district's curriculum coordinator, agrees. Holding sessions at so many schools means students likely already know the teachers they'll be working with and vice versa.
Teachers from the data that they had in the springtime have a pretty good idea of where the kids left off. And also that's why we did it school-based, because our teachers here, they're going to know these kids and what they need. Like, they know them.
The first day of school for most KPBSD students is next Wednesday, August 21st. In Soldotna, I'm Ashlyn O'Hara.
Multiple new Hispanic and Latino-owned restaurants have recently opened in Anchorage. From mole enchiladas to mangonadas, they're bringing new foods to the city. Plus, as Victoria Peterson reports for Alaska Public Media, they're also fostering community spaces for residents looking for a taste of home.
During dinner time at Salsa Oaxaqueña, patrons are often serenaded. In the back corner of the small Spinard restaurant is a stage with a large standing Bluetooth speaker and a microphone. Cesar Flores sings in the restaurant often, belting out corridos, rancheras, mariachis, and other traditional music from Mexico and Latin America. He loves that here, the music isn't just from the radio.
But here is like a real people, real singers, or real everything, live music. So that's it's cool, really. Especially for Alaska and Anchorage, really, I love it.
Siblings, Rosie and Abraham Martinez Martel, along with Abraham's wife, Selena Vasquez Lopez, are all part owners of the new restaurant, which opened July 1st. It was Abraham's idea to offer karaoke.
A family member came and started singing, and everyone liked it. They thought it was something different.
The family moved to Alaska from Mexico within the last decade, and they're a part of a growing Latino and Hispanic community in Anchorage. Inspired by a desire to share cultures, create community spaces, and bring something new to the Alaska restaurant scene, Salsa Oaxaqueña is just one of several new Hispanic and Latino-owned restaurants that have opened in Anchorage this year. And these new businesses aren't limited to the city. Lena Mariscal, owner of the French Bakery and the editor of Anchorage's Spanish newspaper, Sol de Medianoche, says she's noticed a handful of new Latino and Hispanic-owned eateries popping up all across the state.
It's exciting to see just how much new businesses we have, how many different ways of preparing something there is.
Since Lena first arrived in Alaska 40 years ago, the state's Hispanic and Latino population has grown rapidly.
Say, when we lived in Kenai, the only Spanish-speaking families were my grandparents and us. And every time you heard Spanish somewhere, you were like excited to hear it.
Between 2000 and 2010, the population of Hispanic people in Alaska grew by nearly 52% and includes many people who come to the state looking for job opportunities. Today, about 8% of Alaska's population and about 9% of Anchorage's population are Hispanic and Latino, with roots in Mexico, Guatemala, El Salvador, Puerto Rico, Colombia, and more.
And you hear Spanish everywhere. And it's not just from, you know, one specific country. It's from any country in Latin America or even Spain that are here in Alaska.
Daniela Villa, along with her husband Jesus Villa, are part of Alaska's growing Hispanic and Latino community. They're originally from Acucio del Canje, a small town in Michoacán, Mexico. At their brightly colored Mexican ice cream shop in Anchorage, which opened earlier this summer, a bold mural depicts the faces and buildings of their small hometown. Daniela says they wanted to bring something new to Anchorage that reminded them of being in Mexico.
We started working on basically getting the recipes down, going down to Mexico and finding out how to make the artisanal Mexican ice cream and popsicles.
The shop's menu is long and varied, with an emphasis on freshness. They use Alaska-grown products whenever possible, and customers can choose from dozens of different paletas, or popsicles, ice creams, street food specialties like tortas, ceviche, and cooling beverages and snacks like agua frescas, horchatas, and mangonadas.
A lot of people come in and they're like, oh goodness, we feel so overwhelmed with everything that's on your menu, but it's nice to know that they even feel that it's something new that we're bringing into Anchorage.
While some Anchorage residents are new to the shop's offerings, others are flocking to La Michoacana for a taste of home.
Well, we feel, I want to say, very proud of ourselves that we have created a place for families to come in and for them to feel welcome. And not just our Hispanic community, but any community that comes in, just to feel welcome that this is a place for their family.
Back at Salsa Oaxaqueña, Anchorage residents are also excited about finding the foods of a home that many of them miss. All of the owners and chefs are from the Chiqui indigenous group of Oaxaca, and the restaurant's menu is centered on the flavors from that area.
Yeah, everyone's been supporting us from Oaxaca since it's the first Oaxaca restaurant here. Everyone was surprised.
Mole, tamales, tlayudas, chile verde enchiladas, and salsas made of molcajetes are some of the specialties being served. The owners are awaiting a shipment from Oaxaca full of regional foods that will allow the restaurant to continue expanding its menu.
When people come, they're surprised because it's a whole new taste, a new flavor. It reminds them of the food from their parents, their grandparents. If they feel like they're at home.
Everything about Salsa Oaxaqueña is inspired by Inez Silva, the Martinez family's matriarch who had to stay in Mexico. And until they're reunited, serving her favorite foods is helping the owners and some residents of Anchorage's Latino and Hispanic community stay connected to the family, culture, and traditions back home. In Anchorage, I'm Victoria Peterson.
Alaska was the second-to-last state to hold on to a Blockbuster video rental store. The last one closed in 2018. But as Alaska Public Media's Anissa Vitsa learned, for some in Anchorage, the nostalgic appeal of old media hasn't gone away.
Matt Jardin lives in a typical single-family home in Airport Heights. It's got typical beige siding and a typical white front door. But in the middle of his front yard is something a little atypical.
We are looking at the free Blockbuster that I have just sitting out in my front yard.
It's a giant blue box with the unmistakable yellow Blockbuster logo on the side. It's about 4 feet tall with two plastic doors covering shelves filled with DVDs. Jardin just put it up a few weeks ago.
So basically a little free library, but for DVDs, Blu-rays. Some people have put VHSs in there. I don't know if people have VCRs to play them, but there are VHSs in there.
Anyone can take a movie or leave a movie. You don't even have to return it or leave something in exchange. Jardin is a filmmaker and a self-professed cinephile, so once he saw the idea for the free Blockbuster on Reddit, he was inspired to make his own.
It kind of harkens back, you know, to me, to an old way of discovering movies. You would just kind of walk through the store and just try to discover something that you might not have heard of. Of course, with a free Blockbuster, you're not really able to walk down any hallways. But, you know, if we could carve out just a tiny slice of that nostalgia, then great.
Jardin created his free Blockbuster using an abandoned newspaper box. According to freeblockbuster.org, it's the first and only registered free Blockbuster in Alaska. There are dozens in the lower 48, spread across 43 states.
It's been a really cool response in such a short amount of time. So I've noticed neighbors coming by and just dropping off stuff. A lot of people were like, oh yeah, totally, that seems really cool.
One neighbor, Lisa Schweitzer, heard about the Blockbuster on Facebook. When someone she works with dropped off boxes full of DVDs from a decommissioned Redbox, she immediately thought to donate them to the Blockbuster.
I thought it was a cool idea. There's a lot of people that have, like, you know, places where they don't have like internet access, like cabins and things like that, where they still use that kind of stuff. So I think it's something that's definitely like not phased out here as much as it is in the lower 48, because people still kind of have a need for it in those kind of aspects.
Jardin agrees that Alaskans have a tendency to do things old school, pointing out that Rainbow Video only closed in the past year. But even as he spearheads the free Blockbuster movement in Alaska, Jardin admits he's actually not a big DVD watcher himself. He says he likes the convenience of streaming, But it doesn't replace the value of actually owning a movie you really love. Something he also saw reflected on the free Blockbuster website.
The purpose of it was to kind of like combat this myth of scarcity when it comes to entertainment and combat the idea that when something is pulled off of streaming, you know, it's gone forever.
The free Blockbuster is on the corner of Columbine Street and 19th Avenue. It's quiet there, and you can sit in the front yard and page through the plastic DVD cases. There's Annie the Musical, several seasons of the TV series Community, Game of Thrones, a documentary about drag kings, and even some Alaska-specific movies, including The Adventures of Monty the Moose.
Oh, this one stands out to me. A whole box set, the Blu-ray box set of the Lord of the Rings trilogy, and it's the extended editions too. This is pretty fancy.
Jordan hopes that people will feel comfortable taking whatever they want. Maybe that's an old favorite that you can finally say you own. Or maybe it's to discover something entirely new. In Anchorage, I'm Anissa Vitsa.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Jack Darrell in Ketchikan, Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, Chris Clint, Victoria Peterson, and Anissa Vitsa in Anchorage, Robin in Fairbanks, and Ashlyn O'Hara in Soldotna. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer tonight is Tobin Shelby. Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.